Here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Monday. Support for WEAA is provided by ADT. More information available at ADT.com. Coming up in the second hour of the show, Khadija Ali Coleman, host of Living Unbound with Khadija Ali Coleman, will join me for the hour. We have a guest coming in for one of the segments. Tara Marshall is owner of Healing Spaces Wellness. We're going to be talking about if you don't want to do this anymore, I don't want to do this anymore, reaping the benefits of healthy choices and taking back your life. I think that can resonate with a lot of people. So looking forward to that conversation during the Living Unbound segment with Khadija Ali Coleman. Before we get to the second hour, we will be joined by Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, professor of communication and African-American studies in the Department of Communication at Loyola University, Maryland, author, also Afro contributor, will join us to talk about her response to Charlottesville. That's coming up a little bit later in this first hour. But before we get to Dr. K. Wise Whitehead, Mark Royd, a veteran reporter of the Baltimore Brew, joins us by phone. Mark, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you, Sean. Glad to be here.
Of course. Before we get started, Mark, let me remind the listeners to make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9. And don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page if you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me. I'll share it with the people unless you don't want me to, and I won't. Let's go back to Mark Reuter on the phone, investigative reporter for the Baltimore Brew. Mark, let me start by just kind of unpacking for our listeners who have not learned some of the specifics of this attack. A domestic terror attack connected to a so-called Unite the Right rally, composed of neo-Nazis, skinheads, Klansmen, and various other hate groups in Charlottesville, Virginia over the weekend, injured 19 counter-protesters, some critically, and killed one, 32-year-old Heather Heyer. The attack was carried out by 20-year-old James Alex Fields of Ohio. When he rammed a car into the counter-protesters, he's charged with second-degree murder, among other charges, and being held without bail. According to U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, the DOJ is launching a civil rights investigation into Heyer's death. The response of Donald Trump on Saturday following the attacks included his condemnation of, quote, the egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. Those are the three words that so many people are keying in on many sides. That's really the only statement in the minds of many people. The only statement that really matters from Donald Trump, whatever he said today, is just cleanup, if you will, from what he said on Saturday. In Baltimore, and around the country, tens of thousands took to the streets over the weekend to protest. And Baltimore's mayor, Catherine Pugh, said she would move forward with removal of Baltimore's Confederate statues. Again, Mark Reuter is here on the phone with us at the Baltimore Brew to talk about Baltimore's official response to Charlottesville. Mark, this is sort of curious, and you wrote about this in the Brew today. It seems like another task force that the mayor is calling for. I'm going to read part of her statement that was sent out this morning. It says, it is my intention to move forward with the removal of Baltimore City's Confederate statues. Various tasks that need to be completed include identifying legal requirements for deaccession, negotiating and executing agreements with potential recipients, procuring funding, and receiving approval from the Maryland Historical Trust Easement Committee for moving the Lee Jackson Monument. I have taken steps to appoint a working group to lead the process for removing. I mean, this is rather pragmatic on the part of the mayor in response to what has happened in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Right. And this, of course, goes back 2 years, Sean, when Mayor Rawlins Blake, the former mayor, appointed another task force, a commission, to study the four Confederate related monuments in Baltimore.
Right.
And that report, after voluminous public hearings and a very detailed and very elegantly written report, it's really, I was just reading it today and was very impressed with that. Unlike most government reports, this actually tells you a lot about the context of these monuments and the significance. But that report came out August 15th of last year. Rawlins Blake sat on it for the final 3 months of her term, and Pew has sat on it in the first 7 months of her new term, and then suddenly this blew up in Charlottesville, and everyone's maybe in City Hall running for cover or other various like activities.
Yeah. Brandon Scott, today, I believe, during a city council luncheon, didn't call for the removal of the statues, called for the destruction of all four statues.
Right. The recommendations that the report had a year ago was pretty mild-mannered. It called for two of the four statues to be physically removed,
right,
but not destroyed, not touched, to be preserved, and to make arrangements for them to go probably in a Confederate cemetery. There's several in Maryland. There's also several in Virginia. The other two would remain where they are now, intact, but would have what they call contextualization or a description about them. And that's one of the main factors here that that brings this kind of to national as well as local attention. As I said, there's four monuments. They're publicly owned, publicly maintained. Three of the four were directly created, funded, and developed by Confederate Daughters of the Confederacy, Confederate Veterans Group, and others who were all part of the movement after the Civil War that gained huge strength in Baltimore as well as cities for literally segregation, covenants against blacks and Jews in sections of the city. And this was a lot the ideological foundations of this. And the actual monuments, if you read them, are pretty amazing. One of the monuments, the one on Mount Royal Avenue, gives prominently in its inscription, "God Our Vindicator," which was the motto of the Confederate States during their rebellion. It also says, "Glory stands behind or beside our grief." The Lee Jackson Monument, maybe the most controversial of them all, across the street from the Baltimore Museum of Art.
Right.
Is inscribed in many things. It says many things, but one is prominently "Purpose So Great."
Right.
So these are pretty explicit creations to extol and to the Confederate cause, of which was deeply tied in first with slavery and then with resegregation and Jim Crow, which hit this city so hard. And, you know, what's fascinating is that that period began in the 1890s, got much stricter in Baltimore around 1910, and didn't really end until really the 60s. And this is the legacy of unequal distribution of housing, of public facilities, of voting that is what we're struggling with to this day.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yost, your host. I'm on the phone with veteran journalist Mark Reuter of the Baltimore Brew. We're talking about Baltimore's response, Baltimore's official response, Mayor Catherine Pugh's official response to the Charlottesville attacks. It seems obvious that this is a direct response because this mayor and the previous mayor didn't do anything about the commission's report on the four Confederate monuments here in Baltimore until what transpired over the weekend during those domestic terror attacks, which injured 19 and killed one person, Heather Heyer. Mark, let's drill down a little bit more on the Lee Scott monument specifically. You mentioned the aspects of segregation and how they were implemented in Baltimore methodically over decades from the late 1800s into and up into really the 1960s and 1970s. And still many of the remnants and vestiges of segregation remain in place in the city. But that statue in particular, they keep talking about or the narrative is always about these are commemorating the Civil War. So let's look at specifically the Lee Jackson statue. That statue was erected in the 1930s, 70 or 80 years after the completion of the Civil War. That statue was erected in an era when Baltimore's black community was building a powerful civil rights infrastructure led by, in some part, Thurgood Marshall, Juanita Jackson, Clarence Mitchell Jr., Carl Murphy of the Afro. Baltimore's black community was becoming a powerful civil rights vanguard in the United States, one of the most powerful in the United States. And here comes this statue right at that time, at the incipience of that movement. 3,000 people gathered for the dedication of that statue, including the governor of the state. So this was a big deal. And it seems to confirm what you were alluding to, that this was a strike for segregationists as opposed to a commemoration of civil war.
Right, because there was no commemoration to the Union soldiers. They are completely out of this. This is directly the Confederate cause, Confederate soldiers, Confederate leaders like Lee and Jackson, and of their martyrdom and of their cause, which the monuments explicitly say is the cause that has God on their side. And this was had a number of other aspects to it. One is the growth in the, before these segregated laws came to pass in Baltimore, these deed covenants, etc.
Right.
And those are laws, you know, not even social practices. Before that came the books and the propaganda, however you want to put it. And one of the early people was a Richmond, Virginia journalist who, right after the end of the Civil War, his name was Edward Pollard, published a book called The Lost Cause.
Mm.
And several years later, The Lost Cause Regained. And both of those books explicitly wrote about the supremacy of the white man, and the total defense of slavery. But they also, as other books became very popular in these circles, just like we now are finding out about all of these things in the alt-right, you know, all of this propaganda that comes from all these different sources.
Right.
And there was a lot of confusion going on. A lot of the Confederate people, ones who were involved in these monuments directly or indirectly, giving money for them, backing them in other ways, going to meetings, was to say such things as the South, that slavery wasn't an issue, that the South had the right to secede from the Union, because back at the time of the Civil War, they were rebels, they were traitors, they were traitors to the Union in the view of Abraham Lincoln. That they would have eventually ended slavery, that slavery was part of an esteemed, cherished Southern life and gentility that the North did not have, and, you know, Gone with the Wind, Birth of a Nation, came out of this same very period, of these monuments, of what was this widespread belief. But we can only call it propaganda because it wasn't true. They did secede from the Union. They were rebels. States' rights did not include succeeding from the Union and drawing fire on Union boats and stuff, which precipitated the Civil War. So this is a kind of an alternate history that is why a number of people think that this is pernicious, you know, is something that needs to be corrected.
Let me give you one more question before we take some phone calls, Mark. Brandon Scott, councilman of the 2nd District, as I alluded to earlier, said he wants the statues destroyed. Is there any way that the city council, there's already a process, it seems, in place, a very methodical process to have the statues removed? And specifically, this step here, checking in, basically, with, or rather, any... The Maryland Historical Trust Easement Committee. There's a very specific step. It's connected to the city charter, I believe. That forces any administration, any mayor, to go through, for lack of a better term, the Maryland Historical Trust Easement Committee in order to remove a statue. But let me ask you this: is there any way that the council could actually put this to a vote and vote on having these statues destroyed as opposed to two removed and then the other two which remain contextualized today?
I think no. And not to even speak of that, there would clearly be lawsuits. There might be action taken by the state. You know, the easement business with the historical trust is, you know, very Baltimore in history.
True.
It's that Baltimore didn't want to and no longer was maintaining these statues. So in order to get the state and this agency to maintain them, they gave them easement. On that Lee Jackson monument, that actually was, most of the money was raised by a banker called Ferguson back in the
20s. Right.
And he has a certain in perpetuity rights for that statue as that is in the law. What, you know, Brandon is getting at, though, and I think his frustration of many people, is that over a year has passed, two administrations have been before us, and the process of getting the statues removed and not destroyed, but removed and placed either in storage and eventually into another cemetery hasn't even started.
Right.
And the mayor said today is that she would follow a year-old plan and that it would take many, many months, if not more, if the city even remains diligent on this. And it could well, after a few months, we go on to other issues and, again, the statues sort of remain and linger on.
Stand by, Mark. Let me take some phone calls real quick. I don't have a lot of time. Let's go to Hank quickly in Baltimore. Hank, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
How you doing today, gentlemen? I got one question, right? I just want to know one thing, right? If somebody took down a statue of Thurgood Marshall, right, how many black people would be trying to lose their mind? Right? Now, I don't agree with the statues, right, because of the racist connotations of them, right? But, however, that is our history, right? And if by any chance you want to learn the lessons from your history, you have to put the good with the bad with the good. So as well as you got the Lee and Jackson and these other statues up there, why can't you beside them place other statues which refrain from the thought frame of slavery and segregation?
Okay.
Right?
Hank, thank you. Your phone is breaking up pretty bad. Donna, let's go to you. Donna, you're on First Edition. How you doing?
Pretty good. We need to learn from our history. When I traveled overseas, you know, they didn't take down the, you know, what happened in Nazi Germany. Those are rememberings of what happened. Same thing in Rwanda with all the murders. All the people who died are still there, mummified. So we really need to find a way to maybe even put these statues in a museum, and actually put the true history of what who these people were and what they represented to remind us not to ever go back that way again.
Donna,
we need to learn from our history.
Donna, let me ask you this question, though. The fact that one of the statues, especially specifically the Lee Jackson statue, seemed to be installed really not as a commemoration of the Civil War, but more as a symbol of white supremacy.
Right.
That doesn't that seem to just be something that is antithetical to a city that is, first of all, majority black, and second of all, certainly trying to pull away from that history of and the current remnant of white supremacy in this city?
If Dr. Welsing was still alive today, she would actually say, keep the statue and tell us the history of who this person was, what white supremacy is, and how not to go back.
Okay.
We can't erase our history.
Fair enough.
It's like overseas, they didn't erase. When you go overseas and go tour these sites, they didn't erase our history.
Understood.
As horrifying as it was, they didn't erase it.
Understood. Donna, thank you for your call. Let me go to...
One thing, maybe, if I have a second,
sure.
On is... that the overseas, as I understand it, like in Germany, they are commemorations to the Holocaust, and you know, put this in context. The four monuments now, particularly the two, the Tawney, the Roger Tawney Monument in Mount Vernon Square, and the Lee Jackson you've been talking about across the street from the Art Museum. These are right now, displays of the might and the wisdom and the grace and the God-given grace of the Confederate cause, and there's no other, you know, surrounding information whatsoever. They have remained intact for all these years with this, you know, inscriptions of purpose so great, etc.
Right.
One of the problems that your listeners should recognize, and one that really isn't being told, but is certainly talked about in City Hall, is money. Believe it or not, taking down these two monuments might cost, it's unbelievable to hear it, they're saying $500,000 plus.
Yeah.
And that is something that stopped Rawlins Blake and Nancy Pugh. They don't want to spend the money.
Well,
and but sometimes, as with the police consent decree, it's forced upon the city to spend money it doesn't want to.
They find money to spend on litany of things that are not necessarily very logical, but that doesn't stop them. Mark Reuter is a veteran journalist with the Baltimore Brew. Mark, it's always great to hear you reporting on these issues. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. All right, this is what we're going to do. Clarence D., Doc Cheatham, Charles, do not hang up. We will get to your calls. Clarence D., Doc Cheatham, Charles, do not hang up. We're going to be joined by KY's Whitehead in a moment to get her thoughts on the aftermath of Charlottesville. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Here on WEAA 88.9, I'm Sean Yose, your host, as we continue our conversation about Charlottesville and the aftermath. In the studio with me is Dr. K.Y.'s Whitehead. She's Assistant Professor of Communication and African American Studies in the Department of Communication at Loyola University, Maryland. She's an author. She's also an Afro contributor, I'm proud to say. Dr. K., welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, as always, to be here.
Of course. We're going to get to your phone calls in a moment. Clarence, Jason, D, Doc Cheatham, and Charles, we will get to your phone calls. Do not hang up. But Dr. K., I just want to get your overall sense of your reaction to what transpired. I was in a rest. I was running around all day Saturday, and I was in a restaurant, and I saw the repeated coverage on CNN. Then I learned the news that someone had been killed connected to these racist Unite the Right rally or whatever was going on. And what and this, I want to ask you about this. It's curious to me, not curious, but incredible to me that these rallies were being conducted on the campus of the University of Virginia.
Yes, which I think is one of the most interesting parts of it. I think all of this, if you frame the entire thing, it's all very interesting happening under this house that Trump has built. But I think it's even more interesting that it's taking place on the university campus, which is supposed to be designed as a safe space for students, for faculty members, that is a space that you're moving into. It's a hostile space. I'm thinking very, very carefully about the students of color who are going back to University of Virginia shortly, and who are going to need a lot of support because your campus is now a hotbed that has the memory of this type of activity resonating through it.
So, and this has not been, I have not seen a lot of comment on the fact that it took place with impunity on the campus of the
and
University
the boldness, too.
Yeah, exactly. How do you, I mean, obviously you're not a member of that faculty, but it seems incredible to me that this school, despite the fact that it is the school that Jefferson built, would come to the decision that it's okay to go ahead and carry this out.
What I think is, I think it's interesting kind of to point out is that when you think about the history of Virginia and how Virginia is framed, you think about Virginia being the capital of the Confederacy, the fact that Virginia did not want to let go of American enslavement. They wanted to hold forward as being kind of the last vestige that divided races, that worked to keep black people in this position of being servants to them. For them, it meant infinity. So Virginia is this hotbed. Then you think of Virginia more, you know, kind of going down a little bit deeper in terms of Jefferson and Monticello, in terms of Jefferson's history and the ways in which Jefferson wrote about people being equal, men really being equal, at the same time he held people in enslavement. You think about Jefferson's, the way he raped Sally Hemings. People couldn't call it a relationship. I don't see a relationship between a 30-plus-year-old man and a teenager. I believe she was 13 years old. She was 1 year younger than his daughter.
It wasn't
and the fact that she was enslaved. So you know, someone who's enslaved cannot get permission to relationship. And we call that pedophilia in today's society. But you think about that relationship. She is someone that he never actually freed. Even upon death, she remained an enslaved woman, passed on, of course, in that way towards her son, who was supposed to take care of her into her latter years. So with that under the idea of what we're talking about, Virginia is the hotbed for these type of issues. When you talk about igniting the right and what that means to be in this society where people who call themselves white supremacists or neo-Nazis or alt-right, to me, they're all pseudonyms for the Klan. Like, let's be very clear about what they're talking about. They're walking with torches, but they don't have on their sheets. And in the old days, the days when they were trying to keep black people in a position where we were in terror for our lives, where they didn't want us to vote, where we couldn't leave the plantations, where we couldn't rise up and kind of stand in our man and womanhood as full members of this society, it was the rise of the KKK, and that is what we're seeing. I mean, they feel very, very bold to be able to go forward uncovered and push this idea out.
Let's be clear. We said on more than one occasion on this show, when Donald John Trump was racing through the primaries, the Republican primaries, on his way at the ascendancy to become the 45th president of the United States, we said very clearly that this man's rhetoric, the fact that he was operating from a white nationalist political platform, was incendiary, was probably the impetus for Dylann Roof in South Carolina.
Yes.
The impetus of others who have carried out racist attacks, ending some with in death. The young man who went from, I can't remember where he went from, but went to New York and killed
He wanted to kill the first black person that he saw.
Right. Okay. He's from Baltimore.
He was from Baltimore. Yes.
And I believe wholeheartedly that the boldness, that this movement has been encouraged by the 45th president of the United States. They were yelling, "Heil Trump!"
Yes, they were
during the rally that ultimately led to the death of this young woman
and the injury
of 19 others.
What I want to add to that is I'd like to go back a little bit farther before Trump kind of raced through the primaries. I'm going back to the election of Barack Obama the first time, and then the backlash to that, the pushback from this very conservative, rural, white community with this sense that they were losing something. I think about, you know, the closed door meetings of the Republicans trying to come together to figure out what happened here and what have we lost, and thinking about the documentaries that have come out out that have traced how they set up a deliberate plan that led to the election of Donald J. Trump. I think about the Al Jazeera document, you know, This Is America, that came out in 2009, that talked about the rise of the alt-right, you know, in Arizona, and how they were doing the Hail Hitler sign. They were having these kind of violent meetings, and they were walking along the border with their weapons, talking about we're protecting and we're shooting any immigrants that we see. All Donald Trump's election did was just turn the flames up, remove the final arm that kept people away from moving to this level. And we have gotten to this point. There were individuals acting. I'm thinking, of course, like you said, Dylan Storm Roof and the guy from Baltimore. Now we're talking about a collective mess. Not hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in the University of Virginia, but just enough to remind us that we have a very serious issue with race in this country.
I'm going to repeat what Donald Trump said on Saturday. Because what he said,
his real feelings.
Right, exactly. His real what he feelings. Said today is meaningless.
As someone said, that was just a puppet. That was somebody who was like a hostage video, right? Basically. With no emotion.
Because what he said on Saturday was really where he was coming from. The egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many
sides.
On many sides. Those three words spoke volumes, and it shows the true name. This, I mean, we've had several people come out and say that Donald Trump is a racist, that Donald Trump is a white nationalist. Well, we said it years ago.
And it is
abundantly clear. There's no other way to look at it except that this 45th president of the United States has staked out his territory historically, and he is who he says he is.
And he is towing the line, and he has surrounded himself like Steve Bannon, who is a white supremacist, like Jeff Sessions. I mean, Coretta Scott King warned us about Jeff Sessions over 20 years ago about the way he felt about the division in this country and how he believed it was kind of his moral right to keep that division in place. Donald Trump is the man that he is. People are acting like he is changing. They're acting like he is growing. They're acting like the office is making him better. No, he is simply bringing this office down to the place where he has always been. If you go back and you look at Donald Trump in 1980, when he kind of put out the sketches of what Donald Trump Towers was going to look like. And he said, I want people to talk about me and be angry with me, because the more you're angry and the worse criticism I get, the more I'm able to fill up these apartments in my building. So you do that. You talk about me and whatever it takes for me to get into the living room of the American public, that is what I will do. You have to trace the full career of Donald Trump. It didn't start with him running for office. It didn't start with, you know, what is it, The Apprentice? It didn't start there. No. It started with him 25 years ago being a regular visitor through our house, through that television.
In the 1970s, the apartment complex that him and his father were sued over.
Yes, because they didn't want to let black people in.
They didn't want to allow blacks to be tenants at their apartments. His behavior during the trial of the Central Park
Five. Come
Central
on.
Park Five.
And he told the line with that. He never moved back. To this day, he hasn't moved back. I think it was Toni Morrison that said, when people show you who they are, believe them the first time.
It was actually Maya Angelou.
Maya Angelou.
But believe them the first time. He took out full-page ads in New York newspapers calling for the death penalty for these young men.
Yes.
And not apologizing years later after they were fully
exonerated. And that was just recently. He has told the line. Donald Trump is the man that he has always been. But I think what's very frightening about all of this, for many of us who are working to change this current reality, who are looking to be on the front line, and in whatever way that manifests itself for you, whether it's on the front line or you're writing or you're on the radio or you're actually in Virginia protesting, whatever that means for you and how you're articulating your reality, when you think about the work we have to do, and you and I talked about this a bit before the show started, this is an ongoing war. Like, there is no let up in this world that Donald Trump has pierced together. So you're thinking about Virginia, you're thinking about, you know, North Korea, you're thinking about what's happening in Venezuela, you're thinking about what's happening with healthcare. Like, you're just all the time, you're staying in this constant state of anxiety, of hyperarousal.
Destabilization.
And that is what I believe is one of his primary goals, keeping us destabilized, keeping us in this state of hyperarousal, keeping us where we can't get a full sense of what's going on. And meanwhile, he's moving his agenda forward.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yeo, your host. We're continuing the conversation about Charlottesville in the aftermath. In the studio with me is Dr. K. Wise White, Head Assistant Professor of Communication and African and African-American Studies in the Department of Communication at Loyola University, Maryland. She's an author. She is also a contributor to the Afro-American Yay. Newspaper, I'm proud to say. Let's take a few phone calls, Dr. K. Let's go to people been holding on for a long time. Let's go to D in Baltimore. D, you're on First Edition with K. Wise Whitehead. How you doing?
Oh, turn your radio down.
Yeah. D, are you there or no? All right, let's move on to Clarence next. Clarence, you're on First Edition with K-Wise Whitehead. How you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you, Sean, for taking the call.
Sure.
Dr. Whitehead, you know, you reach a lot more people than the average one of us that calls into the radio station do. One thing I would like to make clear from my point of view is that Donald Trump speaks like the Native Americans would say, with a forked tongue, when he tries to confuse the opposition to hatred as being the same,
right?
You know, by hatred on all sides. And that's something that I think is kind of dangerous when people get confused with that, because the opposition that these people were there opposing the hatred ideology of white nationalists and the superiority, that's not hatred. That's, and you grasp what I'm saying. Now, of course you
yes,
do.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Dr. Whitehead. Bye-bye.
No, I appreciate that. And I think that's something that people have to be aware of as they begin to look at the real argument of what's happening. I think people are still dealing with this feeling of being shocked. I mean, the images that have been coming out of Charlottesville are just overwhelming. I mean, I think of the photographer who's actually recently done a statement talking about that 20 seconds that he felt that he was going to lose his life to get those photographs right, so we can have that moment. It's heart-wrenching to think about someone driving a car through a crowd of people, but it's just as heart-wrenching to think about someone walking into a church and praying with people and then thinking about maybe I shouldn't shoot them and then deciding to do it anyway. Then thinking about someone getting in their car, driving from Baltimore all the way up to New York to just find one black person so that I can kill them. And I don't know if he was going to go on a rampage after that, but I know that the idea was that he was going to kill the first black person that he saw. Like, when we think about what would it take for a person to plan to come down from their home, to come to the University of Virginia, so that we can, under the guise of, you know, standing up for this one monument, really show the world how we're feeling. I think there's a wonderful guy. I think it's a guy, the guy who runs on a Twitter feed about, you know, you're a racist, and his whole he or she or they, I don't want to give a person a personal pronoun, whatever, because I don't know what it is. But what they're doing is they're looking at the photographs and they are working with people to put names
right
to the faces. People have already been fired.
Yeah,
I mean, I love those photographs saying, you know, do you know me? Am I your employee? Am I your employer? Am I your student? That people are being found and they are being named. So you can no longer hide. That is why people wore white sheets, right? So they can
That's
wear
right
a white sheet and burn a cross on Saturday and then sell you bread on Monday
right
or preach to you on Sunday.
Yeah.
Well, you don't have those anymore. So we can name you, we can find you, we can out you, and we can expose you for the racist that you are.
Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Doc Cheatham in West Baltimore. Doc, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
Let me preface my statement by saying, after months of looking into this, the Matthew Hinton Neighborhood Association is the one who called the press conference over a year ago. We invited the councilwoman that represented the district where the Lee Jackson statue is located.
Right.
And that's when we publicly requested as a community group, as residents and taxpayers, that that statue first not be defaced, two, not be destroyed, but assuredly be removed, because the history showed us very clearly that the millionaire who actually paid for it was having it placed in a celebratory nature, that for years, right around the time of the Martin Luther King birthday, the Confederates would actually come there and actually do a celebration every year at that statue. And we
That's
said
right
enough is enough of this.
Right.
It is appalling to me that now we have elected officials now saying almost a year and a half since we did what we did that, oh, they just finally realized it's going to cost some money to remove it. That's boulder dance, because not only did we indicate no defacement, no tearing it down, but once they move in and we got the funds to move it, that we actually represented and suggested, and it's actually on some of the videos that we still have. We requested what would go in its place and that it would cost money to actually replace it. And we were requesting that Harriet Tubman very appropriately be placed in that location. So now here it is, we got council people and the mayor saying that they now come to this great realization that it's going to cost money, and she's communicating with the mayor in another city. We're trying to say, who did she send it to? Kevin Costner? To ride on a horse to get a response? It doesn't take 7 months to realize that the previous mayor and her commission set on it to the degree that it was passed by the commission, and two of those were supposed to be taken down, which was the Jackson Lee. And now that it is being reactionary by the city council and the mayor, oh, we've been sitting on this for 7 months. Now let's have a serious discussion.
Yeah. Doc, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. But it's true. I mean, this is I wrote about this in my column over a year ago when the commission's report came out, and the former mayor didn't do anything about it. And the fact that the current mayor, I don't think that she wanted this to be dumped into her lap, but it is in her lap. And now it's incumbent upon her to do something.
Maybe I think it comes with the office. Anyone who goes in the office today and is surprised by things being dumped in their lap, there's no surprise. These things are building, and it takes a collective action to be able to stand up. I want to be clear that Twitter feed was at Yes, You're Racist, where they are outing people. One example is Peter Taft. I mean, they outed him, put the picture up. His family responded immediately and said, we are 100% against our son's racism. We are now denouncing our son and the fact that he is on the front line doing this. That is how we out these people. We inform their families. We inform their employers. You can no longer hide. Mm. This is a divisiveness that's destroying the family. But I sent out a tweet saying, if we really want to get to the heart of naming the white supremacists, I put a picture of Donald Trump. Help me name this man. Like, let's out him.
Well, I remember Maxine Waters saying early on, who is this man?
Who is this man?
Who is this man? It's a profound question.
It is.
Who is this man?
Yeah, that's
because when you see
question.
Him day in and day out, this man is not operating on the best interest of the United States.
No. And it seems as if people are doubling down in their support of him. I just think that there's something very frightening happening in the country. And I don't consider myself to be someone that's like, I'm just so surprised that the country is racist. No, there's something very frightening. There's another level that's happening here where people are willing to go to the first step of being violent by any means necessary. I'm going to run my car and I'm going to kill as many people as possible. This is a 20-year-old kid, right? And so I use the word kid. I know we talk about the fact that they tend to age black boys. I understand that. We tend to infantilize, you know, white males. I get that. But at 20 years old, I'm thinking, you know, this is what, a junior in college, someone who's just starting their life out. And you get it in your mind that this is what I am called to do. And to have his mother say, well, I don't understand why he's doing it. He has black friends. Well, I'm sorry. It goes deeper than that. And I am calling out in a very serious way a lot of my white Facebook friends. You stood up and you talked about Black Lives Matter. You held my feet to the flames. You wanted to know why I was so violent and what was the end. Why are you so quiet now? Do not tell me that you're one of the good ones and this would never be me. No, go get your people. Bend your privilege and speak out against
go
this.
Get your people.
Go get your people.
Go get your people. That's the go get your people.
Go get your people. Because you tell me to go get mine.
Right.
Go
get your people. Go get your people. Let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Deborah, who has a thought about the Klan. Deborah, you're on First Edition with KY's Whitehead. How you doing?
Thanks very much. I just want to say everything you're saying is so great, and the specific thing about how dizzyfying the Trump, the Venezuela, the constant barrage. But what I wanted to talk about was the idea you said really strongly about, let's not make any mistake, this is the Klan. My concern about using that is that we'll somehow thinking we can manage it like the past. This is a totally new kind of danger. You see what I'm saying? That the concern I have about saying this is the Klan, and then I'm doing a semantic thing, I think, except that the power of the words, because history to me is one of the biggest things that people don't know. We don't know where we've been, and that it.
I don't know, Deborah just faded out. Let's keep going, though, Deborah. Sorry about that. Let's go to Jason next. Jason, you're on First Edition with KY's Whitehead. How you doing?
Hey, Brother Sean. How you doing, family?
Hey, brother.
Hey.
Today on our show, we had a guest that called in a caller that called in and said that we're probably opening up kind of a Pandora's box here. If we start destroying the monuments, we really should start looking at the names of the streets, the names of buildings, the names of parks, and maybe looking overall at all the effects that the Civil War may have left behind in this city. So we just can't just look at statues, because, again, we have buildings, we have streets, we have other monuments throughout the city that are named after many Confederate folks and many slave owners locally here in Baltimore, Maryland. So just something to think about, because, again, when you start looking at attacking one particular thing, looking at statues, again, we may have to look at the overall picture of what the Confederacy has left behind.
Understood.
In Baltimore City, and what slavery has left behind in Baltimore City. And again,
right,
that is the naming of streets and monuments and buildings throughout the city.
Jason,
not just four statues.
We got you. Thank you, brother.
I completely agree with that. I agree with the Pandora's box, that whole idea. I think that one of the things with Pandora's box, when you open it up, there's all this evil inside. But at the bottom of the box, if I remember the story correctly, there was a thing called hope at the bottom of the box. That to get to hope, you had
to get through all these
other things. I think we've never completely wrestled with the legacy of American enslavement in this country. We haven't really wrestled with it in Baltimore specifically. And I just want to say very quickly with this idea of the Klan, because I want to answer the caller's point. The notion behind the Klan was to terrorize, was to oppress, was to divide, was to separate, and if necessary, it was to kill black people publicly so that other black folks would be afraid, or other white folks who believed in the cause would be afraid to stand up. What is happening now with the rise? I just hate this notion of the white supremacists, the anti, you know, the neo-Nazis, alt-right. The same goal is there. What does it mean to march through a town with torches yelling, "Ignite the right," or "Jews can, you know, won't keep us or won't oppress us"?
It is
to terrorize.
It's terror.
It is to divide. It is to press. It is to separate. And if necessary, as we saw with this driver, to kill. That's why I'm saying it's the same. I don't like playing a semantics game. I'm saying let's call it what it is. And maybe by calling it what it is, and we don't use these clean terms like alt-right or white supremacists, then people will have the same concern today that they had about the Klan in the 1960s.
Understood. Let's go to back to D. I believe we got our line reestablished. D, you're on First Edition with KY's Whitehead. How you doing?
Hi. Thank you, Sean, for taking the call.
Sure.
Let me say this to the woman who's there sharing and being certain we get
Dr.
all this
Whitehead.
History. The two words I have no problem standing and saying is that what has been loosed is sinister and evil.
Yes.
I have no problem saying that. Okay? And the other thing is that all this energy of these evil persons, it's misguided. They should know, if they knew the history, that no one needs to be reminded of racism by the existence of a monument.
Truth.
Because racism is baked into the very social fabric.
Mm.
All right? It's in the fabric. Whether the monument stands there or not, they know full well why those monuments were there. Thank you, Sean Nils, for getting that history out there. And I will leave with this. I have maintained all along that when POTUS said that he was going to drain the swamp, America did not realize that in so doing, he was emptying the sewer.
Yes.
Indeed. D, thank you for your comments. We appreciate it.
So glad she got back on the line.
Me too.
Because I absolutely agree. I love that one line. I wrote it down, D. Racism is baked into the very social fabric, and I would add to that in the blanket that's covering this country.
Well, and to even to Jason's point, when he talks about the fact that we have to look at street signs, parks, that is descriptive of the fact of just how pervasive the Confederate influence was in this city.
Yes.
How pervasive white supremacy was in this city. It touched every aspect of our lives to a great extent, and it continues to, the remnant of it continues and in very bold ways with these statues placed three of them in very close proximity to each other, quite frankly.
Yes. And that place right after the ending of the war.
No.
I mean, typically when you lose a war, they don't put monuments up in your honor. That does not happen. I also think in a very bold way, when we think about the Confederate flag, not just here in Maryland, I'm thinking about the fact that I was up, you know, on the Canadian border and there were Confederate flags up there. Mm. I mean, so this kind of tension that comes out from the South has found its way into every aspect of this country. White supremacy is not just in Virginia.
No.
I mean, at some point, and when if Mayor Pugh does move forward, I know she's doing another commission to study, but if she does move forward, I would not be surprised if they end up here in Baltimore. And then I'm going to ask people, where do you stand on this? Baltimore is not a place you come and play with.
No.
You're coming to Baltimore to make a stand. No. This is a place you need to be very serious about the ways in which we organize against white supremacy in this city.
No, I agree, and I don't think they're coming. I really don't.
We were waiting for Trump to come. We talked about that on your show. Is it okay? Come on here.
We handle that. And I don't believe they have the audacity to do it.
This is not the place. And I don't mean that as a threat. I'm just being very clear about the ways in which we quickly organize in Baltimore City. I think that is one of the strengths of this city. We don't lie down for things like that. We stand up against them.
And we will. K.Wise Whitehead is Assistant Professor of Communication and African American Studies in the Department of Communication at Loyola University, Maryland. She is an author and a contributor to the Afro newspaper.
Yay.
Dr. K., great to see you as always.
Always.
Appreciate
Thank you, sir.
All right. We're going to take a quick break when we come back. The second hour, first edition, Living Unbound with Khadijah Ali Coleman, special guest Tara Marshall, owner of Healing Spaces Wellness, will be here as well. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition.